from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Pope Francis recently approved a second miracle attributed to the intercession of Blessed John Henry Newman, paving the way for his canonization. This week on Register Radio, we talk to the Register's UK correspondent, K.V. Turley. Plus, 60 years after its invention, the Filet-O-Fish sandwich remains a staple for Catholics during Lent. Patty Armstrong tells us the fascinating history of the beloved McDonald's sandwich. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio. I'm joined by Matthew Bunsen, the Register's senior editor and co-host for Register Radio. Hi, Matthew.
Hello. A blessed Lent to everybody.
Absolutely. Catholics all over the world are celebrating the news last month that Blessed John Henry Newman will be canonized later this year. We don't know the date yet, but the news is especially exciting to Catholics of England. Joining us now to discuss the canonization of Blessed John Henry Newman is the Register's UK correspondent Kevin Turley, also known in our pages as KV. Hi, KV. How are you?
I'm very well, Jeanette. Good to have you back on the show.
It's really good to be back, and I wish that we could have you here in person in the studio, and I hope that happens someday soon. I know some of my team members have seen you in London and have gotten wonderful tours of the city.
And, I would be one of them, in fact.
Exactly. Matthew and Joan have seen you in the past year. But KB, you are somewhat of a historian and an expert on Catholicism in England. You've given tours of that kind of thing to my teammates. And really, I think you can bring to us a real sense of how big this news is for England, the news, of course, of the canonization of Blessed John Henry Newman.
Yes, I mean, it's news which has been long awaited and much anticipated. And I have to say, it's been expected, Jeanette.
Sure.
It didn't come as a shock. What has surprised me, though, is the speed with which John Henry Newman has been doing his heavenly work in the last 10 years or so. I mean, suddenly we've gone from a figure who there wasn't a great deal of cult amongst your average Catholics compared to other saints, but suddenly he's moved center stage.
And why do you think that is? Is there something that increased the awareness of Newman and helped to generate that cult, which means, you know, that people would start praying through his intercession? How did that happen?
Well, when you were asking me, my reaction was it's the Holy Spirit,
of course,
and I mean that in a serious sense, in the sense that, I mean, the cult around Newman is a relatively modern phenomena. I think I'm right in saying Matthew can guide us on this, but I think around about the late 50s, there were certain books written by Louis Boyer and others who started to really the modern sort of interest in Newman and his thought, and principally his thought. That never went away and increased over the years, especially after the Vatican Council. So Newman was coming to the fore in sort of intellectual circles more than, say, popular piety. I think, though, I mean, it's not for nothing that when he was beatified, Pope Benedict came to England, as you know, and beatified him. But at the same time, the Ordinariate started. And Pope Benedict initiated that. So and in some ways that you could say is the final stage, if you like, of the whole Oxford movement. I don't know, Matthew, if you would agree that this is all part of a historical continuum, starting with one man's inquiry into the Catholic faith in the 1830s.
I would actually, yeah. I go back to Pope Benedict XVI's homily at the beatification. And when she talked about that engagement with culture and of course, his speeches while he was visiting England, talking about that as well, but also this pursuit of truth.
And KB, you know, you've been working on a story for the Register. We haven't published it yet, and this is one of the blessings of Register Radio, is we get to give our readers a little tease about what's in the works. But you've been working on something about where Newman lived. So a bit of a sort of travel feature, if you will, if anyone wants to head over to England and to see these places, but give us a list of the places you've been writing about.
Yeah, I mean, there are four sort of cities which dominate the life of Newman. First of all, London, where he was born and grew up, essentially. And then Oxford, where he studied and went through a series of religious conversions and then a deepening of his Catholic faith at Littlemore, which is just on the outskirts of Oxford. And then his choosing to live out his priestly ministry at the Oratory in Birmingham, which is England's second city and very much an industrial city. It had none of the glamour or culture of London and was very much to the fore of the English Industrial Revolution. So a very, very different city. But he's also closely linked with Dublin. I was in Dublin recently and, you know, you walk around Dublin, you see bits that are linked very, very clearly with John Henry Newman around Stephen's Green. There's a church which is known colloquially as Newman's Church to this day. It's very popular with marriages and people getting wed and stuff. But also the whole University College in Dublin is essentially part of what he tried to do for many years. And I think he crossed the Irish Sea at a time when crossings were pretty rough in terms of 3 or 4 hours of sailing backwards and forwards, about 30 or 40 times in his life, trying to set up this university, which ultimately failed. So he's a very sort of interesting historical figure. As you know, he lived for a very long period of time and is very much a kind of you can almost map English Catholicism through the life of Newman.
And is that what you're going to be doing in your write-up for the Register?
I hope so. I mean, I'm hoping to use the geographic locations as ways of telling the aspects of his faith journey. Because the one thing about Newman is that he did travel a lot and he wrote a lot and he moved about. But his journey was really interior. And what you see...
Absolutely.
Yeah, and what you see is a great mind who is seeking the truth. He's not seeking to reaffirm what he thought was the truth, but actually the truth. And it's this ever-deepening and very beautiful journey into the truth.
And it's an intellectual pursuit, obviously, for him. His intellect is out there in all of the books that he has written. In fact, many people in the United States get to know him when they are college students because of the Newman Centers, which are the centers of Catholicism at secular universities. And I think that's one of the things that has helped, you know, men and women in the U.S. to become aware of Newman and to sort of enter into this cult that you spoke about in the last 10 years. It's curious that both of the miracles have been in North America.
Well, this is why I think that the gift of Newman's sanctity and canonization is to the whole church. I think North America, the kind of interest in Newman is very much alive in the United States, perhaps even more so than in the British Isles. But I think as well, Jeanette, I'm sure it hasn't gone past your and Matthew's notice that he was first and foremost a priest. I mean, ultimately, he was a great intellect and he's a great writer. He's a beautiful writer, in fact, but he was a priest. And we really do need an affirmation of the priesthood at this time. And I do not see it as coincidence that this gift is being given to the church through this man's life at this moment.
And I feel slightly obligated to note, too, that both miracles, those who prayed, were first learning about John Henry Newman through EWTN.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable. That's pretty remarkable. I think both of them had had watched a documentary on his life through EWTN and used that as a jumping off point for finding out more about the saint and praying through his intercession. So it's a wonderful part that this network has played in this. KV, I want to pick up on something that you said, though. I mean, it's primarily his priesthood that we really celebrate here. And this is a very, as you say, an important time for us to do that. We hope there will be much renewal through this intercession of Saint John Henry Newman when he's canonized. What do you think, I guess, what is the spiritual significance of this happening at this moment?
Well, I think it's a number of factors. I mean, I think it's this was a very, very pious man, but he was also a towering intellect. And I think that it's that, but he was also, he had a priestly soul. So I think he's perfect for our times when we need. I mean, you were talking about EWTN and people learning about him through that. It doesn't surprise me. This is a man who wrote novels. This is a poet. This is a Renaissance man. You know, he did all these. He's a brilliant speaker. I mean, if anybody wants to read his lectures to the Birmingham public, they are absolutely wonderful discourses, exciting, interesting, intriguing, and quite funny at times. I mean, this is a man that used whatever means at his disposal to spread the word of the gospel. And so if he was around today, I'm sure he would have a show on EWTN. You know?
That's true.
I'd watch.
Yeah, me too. But one of the things that I think is very important, and I may refer to this in the article, but there was an awful lot of sort of scandalous gossipy stuff whenever he was being beatified about the burial of John Henry Newman. I don't know if you're familiar about this. There was actually a book written about this sort of thing. But actually what people forget is that the reason he was buried in the manner that he was buried was so that the priest that he was buried with, and there were a number, it would form a crucifix, it would form a cross. So even in death, he was thinking about his priestly marking, his priestly witness, even in how he was buried. And it's very, very telling that other people have picked up on that and made hay with it for all the wrong reasons. But he is a man who was a priest to his fingertips. And I think that I hope and pray there'll be great fruit coming from that through people reading of his life and reading his writings, his devotional writings and his intellectual writings. And he is a cultural and intellectual force for the future in Catholicism. I know Matthew has done a lot on the Doctors of the Church, and I'm sure, Matthew, you've probably already written a few pieces prophesying that he will be a Doctor of the Church one day.
I have, in fact, yeah, that I think he's a perfect candidate. And now this step of his canonization in many ways clears that major hurdle because of those three requirements that you left a great legacy of teaching, you were a saint, and that you're proclaimed as such a doctor by the Church. So there's no question that John Henry Newman is certainly, once he's canonized, qualified to be a Doctor of the Church.
All right. Well, this has been a great show, and we look forward to that article, KV, that you're writing about his life, where he lived, and the impact that this will have on the Church and the world. When we come back, we'll talk to Register contributor Patty Armstrong about the legendary Filet-O-Fish sandwich. This is Register Radio on EWTN. More when we return.
Sacrifice is a profound virtue Catholics can lovingly embrace, especially during Lent. But this year, why not also indulge in something good for your soul? Give yourself the gift of EWTN's National Catholic Register and stay connected to the latest developments and historical traditions of our Catholic faith. Try the Register for free today and get it delivered to your home, office, or parish. To get your 6 free issues, order online at ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code RADIO. The National Catholic Register. It's the one indulgence you won't ever want to give up. Order online today at ncregister.com/radio. The National Catholic Register. Read faithfully.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio, and I'm here with Matthew Bunsen, my co-host. And we are joined by Patty Armstrong, who is a Register contributor. She's written blogs and features for us for a very long time. She just wrote a wonderful piece on Filet-O fish. That's right. That's the fish sandwich at McDonald's. So it's an easy Friday meal for Catholics during Lent. And the amazing thing is it has a wonderful Catholic story to it. So, Patty, this is a fish sandwich that was basically brought to McDonald's by a Catholic businessman in 1963. Please tell us the story.
Well, not only was it brought, the idea came from a Catholic businessman, but it was because of the Catholic habits, Catholics following the faith. That is what created a situation where Lou Groen in Ohio, he had one of the early franchises. He bought it in 1959, and his was the 69th franchise. At that time, just to get a perspective, hamburgers were 15 cents, cheeseburgers were 19 cents, fries, coffee, soda, milk, everything else was 10 cents, and shakes were the most expensive item on the menu. Can you guess what it was? How much for a shake?
20 cents, but I read your story.
Yeah, I was going to say, you read it. But 20 cents, yes, 20 cents. Milkshakes were the most expensive. And he had a problem because he lived in an area in Cincinnati that was 87% Catholic. And when I was asked to do this story, I looked at previous stories that had been done years ago, a business magazine, I think USA Today did something, and it didn't tell me if he was Catholic or not. I thought, okay, fine, 87% Catholic, but was he Catholic? So when I started investigating this, I tried to find people in the Groen family. And back in the day when you had white pages and telephone books, it was easier.
Right.
But I just kept, you know, backing up against a wall and not being able to find anybody. So what I did was I called the original restaurant and I said, hey, did you guys know you were the first restaurant that had the fish sandwich? And the supervisor said, yeah. As a matter of fact, the original owner's granddaughter just bought this restaurant back.
Patty, you're brilliant. I'm so glad you called that number.
Brilliant. I don't know. It's between the Holy Spirit, the assignment editor at the Register, and timing. And it was perfect timing. I told Amy Smith, who gave me this story, I said, boy, she really must have been listening to the Holy Spirit when she had this idea, because it turned out to be just a fantastic story. So I talked with Erica, his granddaughter, Shadoine is her last name. She had lived in California for 10 years, came back, and you don't get to just buy a franchise. She started out as, I think, maybe a shift manager. She had to work her way up for 5.5 years. And her grandfather, who was, by the way, Catholic, he had at one point owned 48 of franchises, and he sold them all back except a few. He kept two. He gave his son, Paul, two, which was Erica's dad. And so this had not been in the family for a long time.
Yeah.
And it was just, she had worked for McDonald's for 5.5 years, was able, then it came up for sale and she realized, wow, this was my grandfather's restaurant. This is where the filet of fish, which she, by the way, is her favorite menu item. And mine too. You know, I'm not, this isn't a commercial, but I have a real problem with giving up meat on Friday because I give it up all the time. I like fish better.
Yeah, right.
So, for me, I can't go to fish fries and, you know, right, all that stuff. It's like, this is not, it's more of a treat. But anyway, let me get back to the story. So Lou was losing his shirt. On an average Friday, he only made $75 a day. Now, back then, this was very, very early 1960s, like 60, 61, 62. He was going broke. He would make maybe $75 a day, which was not enough. He and his wife and one other employee were working around the clock. It was a small, it just had two windows. It didn't have indoor seating. But down the street was a restaurant, Fitch's, that had a fish sandwich. So I remember as a kid, I'm old enough, I don't know if you guys are, but I'm old enough that I can remember as a little kid, people lining up outside restaurants that sold fish. And that was the case in this area. They went down the street to the restaurant that had a fish sandwich.
That's because you're from the Midwest, Patty. I'm from Louisiana, so it just didn't happen.
Oh, and yeah. I grew up in Hawaii, so it's a...
Okay, well, you guys missed it. But trust me, the line, of course, I'm thinking of Brown's Fish and Chips in Dearborn, Michigan. where the line would snake around the building and you could just smell the fish and chips. And there was a long line of people waiting to get in to eat their fish. So he came up with an idea. He did a lot of research and he came up with a sandwich with cheese on a bun that he wanted to sell. And back then when there were only 69 restaurants, you could go see Ray Kroc, yes, in Chicago. And he introduced the idea of, hey, I want to sell a fish sandwich. And Ray Kroc thought that was a horrible idea. He said, I do not want fish stinking up my restaurants.
I just love it. I love it. So he proposes the hula burger. Yeah,
this is the question I wanted to ask in today's Register Radio. What is the hula burger?
Well, number one, it was a dumb idea. Number two, it was, you think, okay, this guy had to be fairly smart. He came up with McDonald's. Anybody could tell this hula burger was a dud. It was a slice of pineapple and a slice of cheese on a bun. Now, you're from Hawaii. You lived in Hawaii, Matthew. How does that sound?
Horrendous, actually. Even if you grill the pineapple, it still isn't going to work.
So even today, the hula burger didn't catch on. So Ray Kroc had been thinking about maybe a meatless sandwich. So he, Erica said her grandfather was persistent because he was losing his shirt on this restaurant. So Ray agrees to a competition. He says, okay, they picked a day. I'm going to sell my hula burger. You're going to sell your fish sandwich. And the one that has the most sales is going to go on the menu. The hula burger. Matthew, did you read this article? I can have
you
guess.
I did.
So,
let's
you
just
know,
say it didn't go well.
The hula burger won. It made 6 sales that day. And the fish sandwich sold like 360.
That's awesome.
And the rest, as they say, is history. However, I thought, well, I want to hear a little bit about this family. How Catholic are they? And I'm happy to say 2 generations later, Erica and her family are still Catholic.
Yes.
She plans on sending her kids to Catholic school. And she described the Catholic faith as really giving her direction and being at the core of her life. Her grandfather died. I don't have the numbers in front of me. He died a few years ago, 2009.
2011, no? I think. I just read it before the show, thank God.
Right. Yeah, I have to go ahead. 2011, he died, and he was 91, I think. And his wife, Edna, is now 88 years old, and she still walks to daily mass a quarter of a mile from her home.
Yeah, that's just beautiful.
At St. William's Church, where she was married, she and Lou were married. Her parents helped build that church. Erica's parents were married there, and Erica and her husband were married at St. William's. So, like, what a great Catholic story.
It is a great Catholic story. And also in this, embedded in your story is also a little bit of history about fasting, because they weren't talking about fasting only on Fridays of Lent. I mean, they were talking about fasting every Friday. Why?
Yes, thanks for mentioning that, because that was one of the things that was missing from all the other articles too. I thought, okay, let's let people know why this was such a big deal. It wasn't just Lent. Every Friday, he hardly made any money because that was the practice. Catholics had to fast from meat, or it was a sin. It was a sin to eat meat. So Lou couldn't even eat his own hamburgers. And when the pastoral statement on penance and abstinence, the U.S. bishops and some other area bishops said that the Catholic community, they really encouraged Catholics to continue abstaining from meat, but it would be your choice. That was the first, that was the best thing to do, but you could substitute it. People like me who like fish, you know, might want to, actually, after I did this article, thank you, Amy Smith, for assigning this to me, because I've decided, you know what? I'm going to make Fridays. I'm just going to say meatless, no matter what.
Right.
I don't have to choose my very favorite meal of fish and chips, but I can still go meatless because it really was a strong statement. They just didn't say, okay, never mind. You guys can all eat meat now. they really encourage Catholics to continue abstaining from meat on Fridays.
And part of that is because it's a communal fast. I mean, it's something that we do in unison with each other. And I had a priest explain it to me once that was for us to do that is to do something out of obedience. And obedience has is paid a high price in heaven. I mean, the obedience is something that is really cherished. And so it is the first preference of the church that we would fast every Friday from meat, or if we must, to fast from something else that we choose. So I think you're right on, Patty, in deciding, hey, I'm going to do that, even if it's not fish that you end up eating, but, you know, some other meal. I absolutely agree, and I try to do that myself. I do like fish as well, so sometimes it just means, what, a cheese pizza or a grilled cheese sandwich or tuna, which isn't my favorite. So,
although there is an argument, I think, that if you really want to do something penitential, just make your own hula burger.
There you go.
Matthew, I think you hit the nail on the head. And as a matter of fact, I interviewed some people who I put it on Facebook. Hey, if you eat the fish sandwich and you're Catholic, I'm doing a story. I'd love to hear from you. And one of the people actually doesn't like, Tori Oswald said, I do not like the fish burger, and that's why I eat it. So whether it's a hula burger or you don't like fish, I thought that is the perfect Catholic reason to be buying something.
Absolutely.
Is even if you don't like it.
And that was a great touch. That was a great touch. And it's so great that you mentioned how you actually got that person, because I was wondering, how did she get these people to talk about their about the fish sandwich? So, Patty, excellent reporting. I'm always grateful when our reporters dig, and I know we don't have white books anymore, so your white pages anymore, you have to dig a little further. So I always appreciate that. Thanks for what you've done. You can read this story at ncregister.com. It's called How a Catholic Businessman Put the Filet-O-Fish on the McDonald's Menu. And it's actually a high trending story right now, so you can see that pretty easily. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, to check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Mike McCall, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless you.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.